Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for your regular host, David Inge. Our producers are Harriet Williamson and Travis Stanzel, and Henry Frain is at the controls. Glad you're listening. Almost 50 years ago, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that, in the field of public education, the doctrine of separate but equal has no place. The unanimous decision in Brown v. Board of Education held that separate educational facilities for white and black students are inherently unequal and established a constitutional basis for racial integration in schools. The University of Illinois has embarked on a year-long project to examine the legacy of the Brown v. Board of Education decision. As part of this morning on Focus 580, we're pleased to have with us Juan Williams, senior correspondent for National Public Radio and author of several books on the American Civil Rights Movement, including the biography Thurgood Marshall, American Revolutionary. Juan Williams is here on the campus of the University of Illinois to give a public presentation tonight at 7 o'clock in the Folinger Auditorium. This is the inaugural event of the university's commemoration of Brown, and this presentation by Juan Williams tonight is free and open to anyone who would like to attend. During this hour of Focus 580, we'll talk with Juan Williams about the life of Thurgood Marshall, his role in the Brown case, and his profound impact on civil rights in the United States. If you would like to join our conversation, all you need to do is call us, the number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us around the Midwest, or if you're listening on the web anywhere in the U.S., 800-222-9455. A bit more about our guest. Juan Williams is one of America's leading journalists. In 21 years at the Washington Post, he served as an editorial writer, op-ed columnist, and White House reporter. From 2000 to 2001, he was host of NPR's call-in program Talk of the Nation and brought that show to towns across America for a monthly series of radio town hall meetings. His books include the national bestseller Eyes on the Prize, America's Civil Rights Years, 1954 to 1965, a companion book to the PBS series, and This Far by Faith, Stories from the African-American Religious Experience. Juan Williams is also a political analyst for the Fox News Channel and a regular panelist on Fox News Sunday. You may have also seen him on Nightline, Washington Week in Review, Oprah, CNN's Crossfire, where he frequently serves as co-host, and Capital Gang Sunday. You can also hear his reports on NPR and Morning Edition in particular, and we're glad to have him with us.
Jack, it's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you for having me.
Well, we're glad to have you here. When most people today think about leaders in the civil rights movement, they probably don't think about Thurgood Marshall as much as they might.
In fact, right in the introduction of the book, I write that, you know, people think when they focus on civil rights and leaders, they think, of course, of Dr. King, who's sort of the icon of all civil rights efforts. And then they think of almost the complement or the antithesis to Dr. King would be Malcolm X. And so that, you know, Malcolm X, I think, speaks to a lot of young people, especially young people who are struggling with authority and rebellion. And there's Malcolm X, who gave such wonderful voice to the idea of anger at racial oppression in the society. But they're slow to come to Thurgood Marshall, who I think really is the man who broke so much of the ground and really stands tall, even in the company of Dr. King and Malcolm X. But if you think of Marshall as most young people, you know, today would remember him, and he's died 10 years ago now. But if you think of him, you think of kind of this frumpy, overweight guy, you know, in that heavy black cloak of a Supreme Court justice, sort of an authoritarian figure, not the young revolutionary who was out there battling to change American society and to defeat racism in the country. And that image is one that I hope that people can come to, because I think it helps to have that fuller understanding of not only him, but American history, to understand exactly the role he played. He's born 1908 in Baltimore, Maryland, a thoroughly segregated society. And, of course, by the time he dies in January 94, what you have is a man whose life literally is on the same path of a transformed society.
Mm-hmm. You call him really the architect of the civil rights movement.
Oh, I don't think there's any question, Jack. You know, if you think about the idea of the struggle for equality, it is based in large part on the idea that segregation is wrong. It's not the separate but equal, and that we want separate and equal, and we want, you know, if separate but equal for the longest time was really a dodge in American society because there was no separate but equal. They were separate, but they were separate in unequal facilities and treatment of citizens based on their race. Marshall comes in and eventually, with tremendous help from other lawyers at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, principally from Charles Hamilton Houston, who was not only his boss at the Legal Defense Fund for a time, but the man who was the dean at Howard University Law School, where Marshall went to law school, he's able to make the leap that says, no longer am I arguing that separate but equal is the problem, that we need equal facilities. It's an argument that segregation itself, and this comes from something you read at the start of the program, the segregation itself in the area of public education is unconstitutional and a violation of our, you know, Americans' 14th Amendment rights, regardless of race, to have equal treatment under the law.
Mm-hmm. He didn't give a lot of interviews.
He sure didn't.
but you got him to talk to you a number of times over a period of months.
Yeah, well, it was quite a struggle to get there. I really wanted to talk to him for Eyes on the Prize, the book, and to see if he would sit down for the TV series that we did on PBS. But he wanted no part of that, very much gun-shy about reporters, felt that reporters didn't understand him, didn't appreciate him. You know, one of these things, Jack, that you come across in life where you meet someone who is larger than life, and Thurgood Marshall, in terms of his history, his role in history, is a larger-than-life figure, and a Supreme Court justice. I mean, forget, even if he hadn't been this amazing lawyer, he's also a Supreme Court justice. It reminds me that Lyndon Johnson said when he was nominated to the Supreme Court, even if I never put Thurgood Marshall on the Supreme Court, Thurgood Marshall would be a giant of American history, given what he had accomplished before. But as a result of that, you know, to come to know Thurgood Marshall, it really was striking that this giant was a human being. And the human being oftentimes nursed resentments and grudges and felt as if people didn't appreciate him or understand him, felt that he'd been forgotten, had bitterness about race relations, even though he had been so central in achieving this transformation I've been speaking about this morning. And so you have to sort of work with Thurgood Marshall, the human being, and try to tease out, you know, the stories, the reality of what he accomplished. But he was a human being with a lot of hurts.
Well, let's talk about his earlier life that led up to his engagement in the struggle for civil rights. As you mentioned, he grew up in Baltimore, in a very segregated society. People don't remember, you know, well, not too many people remember what it was like in those days, The law of the land was, as you said, separate but equal, established by the Plessy versus Ferguson Supreme Court standard. That was considered equal rights.
Right.
Black students were in some schools and whites were in other schools. And so he attended an all-black high school.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that you write about I thought was fascinating is he was quite a cut-up, and as punishment – one of his teachers made him memorize the U.S. Constitution.
Yes. Yeah, he says that by the time he got out of high school, he knew the Constitution by heart because he would get in trouble on such a regular basis. It wasn't that he was a bad student. He was a pretty good student, but he was a cut-up and, you know, kind of acting out. And even in the best classes, oftentimes, you know, the kind of guy that would just do silly things. And so part of his punishment was not only to learn the Constitution, but to be able to recite it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of odd. Most people, I don't think, could recite the Constitution, but this guy could come out of high school.
And he could see the contradictions.
He could see them literally.
Yeah.
In fact, this is an interesting point because he had a seat in his high school that was next to the window in the room, and outside that window was the police station. And he could see oftentimes black people being dragged in. He could hear arguments. He could hear interrogations. And in addition to which, his father, who had a problem with alcohol but was a steward at the Gibson Island Country Club on the Chesapeake Bay in Maryland, you know, when he would interact with his son, when they weren't screaming at each other over the dinner table, which I suppose helped Thurgood Marshall's skills in terms of argument and debate, he would take his son, Thurgood Marshall, to courtrooms to see what was – so Thurgood could sit in school. He'd watch prisoners come in, see the interrogations. Then oftentimes with his dad – for fun, for entertainment purposes, they would go to courtrooms around the city and watch trials. And so for him, it was a real opportunity to learn how the system worked, to learn how people, powerful people, interacted with the law to recreate the reality of life in what, you know, historians call the middle ground, Baltimore, Maryland, kind of middle ground between North and South.
Mm-hmm. So by the time he graduated high school, someone asked what he wanted to do with his life. He said, I want to be a lawyer.
Incredible, but true. I mean, you know, it's a gift if you're that young and you know what you want to do. But, yeah. given what his dad had always wanted to, I think, be a lawyer, but it was a fantasy given that time period. He knew. And not only did he know, he wasn't sure that he could do it, but he knew and had it in mind, the idea that he could go to Lincoln University, all-black school, then called the Princeton, the Black Princeton, because it was founded by the Presbyterians, Princeton University, New Jersey, founded by Presbyterians for bright young white men, and mm-hmm. Lincoln was for bright young black men. And he was going to go to this school following in his brother's footsteps. And he goes to that school and has what I think of as sort of, you know, an apocryphal experience, because he runs into none other than Langston Hughes. And Langston Hughes, the great writer, the poet, the author, had already been traveling the world, had published poetry and the like, but was coming back to finish his undergraduate education at Lincoln, and runs into Thurgood Marshall, who is big man on campus, big mouth, always screaming for the football team, involved in fraternity pranks, never got over being a prankster. And then he, Langston Hughes, says to Marshall, you know, you've got so much to say about everything on this campus, but you've got nothing to say about segregation on this campus. And Marshall's like, what are you talking about? You know, I came here to have a good time. And he says, no, you know, we have no black people on the faculty. Why is that? You know, and Marshall's like, well, if we have black people on the faculty, they belong to one fraternity or another. There'll be favoritism, all the rest. And it's only after he has an experience of going to a segregated movie theater where he is denied the ability to sit in the lower seating area that Marshall starts to work with Langston Hughes to get the students to make a demand of the administration that they allow black people to serve on the faculty at Lincoln. And a year later, that comes about. That's the first time that I think Marshall has a sense that his, of one, raising his political conscience, but two, that his actions can lead to real change.
Mm-hmm. We have a call to include our conversation. I just want to ask one more follow-up question to make the transition into law school for Thurgood Marshall, and then I promise I'll get to this listener. After he graduated from Lincoln, he wanted to go on to law school, but the University of Maryland Law School, which was right there, wouldn't allow blacks.
No, in fact, it's right there, right down the street from where he was living in West Baltimore, Maryland. But they didn't, you know, they didn't admit colored people, as they said back then. And so he goes to Howard University Law School, which is 40 miles down the road in Washington, D.C., which is where he meets Charles Hamilton Houston, the dean, the man I referred to earlier. But he nurses that resentment. I mentioned earlier that he's a guy who could hold a grudge. A guy could hold a grudge. And he didn't like the fact that he had been unable to attend what would have been not only more convenient because of its location, but a cheaper law school than Howard. And so he strategizes with another young man, someone who had just graduated from Amherst, a young man named Donald Gaines Murray, to make an application to the University of Maryland Law School. Comes back, stamp rejected, we don't accept people of color. Then Marshall asks Murray to write a letter to the university president saying, well, why? You know, I've graduated from Amherst with honors, and I'm a lifelong resident of the state of Maryland. Why can't I go to the university's law school? And the letter comes back saying, well, you know, we don't accept people of color. And with that, Marshall files lawsuit on behalf of Donald Gaines Murray. The suit is heard pretty quickly, much to his surprise, and the judgment is that since there is no equal, separate and equal law school for black students in the state, the University of Maryland Law School must be integrated.
There's a lot more to that, but let's talk with a listener. This is someone in Chicago on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hello, Mr. Williams. This is sort of a technical question. There was a really good biography of Thurgood Marshall written not too long ago. I don't know, maybe 6 or 7 years. I'm sorry, I can't remember the author. So when you came to write yours, what did you say to yourself after reading this? What did you say, I'm going to bring this different angle? Or was it just a story that you really needed to express, even though there was, you know, or did you feel you were bringing in new material? So just the technical question about how you thought.
You know, you may be referring to my book, because my book is published in October of 98, is when it first came out in paperback.
I think I would have remembered your name, because you've been well known for a long time, but maybe I didn't. I'm not sure.
Okay. At the time, I don't think there were any major biographies of Thurgood Marshall, because as Jack mentioned earlier, he was such a reluctant person when it came to talking, to interviewing. There have been some smaller efforts. There's a very good biography of Charles Hamilton Houston, but no, there are very few. There have been subsequent to my book, there have been a few that have come out. some more legalistic. This is really the story of his life and looking at him as a change agent, if you will, somebody who was involved from early in this century, or last century now, I should say, early in the last century, in achieving the kind of step-by-step changes that, in my opinion, have transformed the American landscape, you know, change it to such an extent that it's hard to recognize our position with regard to race. But someone who believed deeply in the idea that real change takes place in the courts. Marshall was a guy, and maybe this is, if you're looking for, you know, the perspective that comes from my writing, it would be that, you know, Marshall's a guy who, you know, would say you could go to a Dr. King speech and it'd be wonderful, it'd be inspiring, thrilling even. But when you went back home, the reality of job opportunities, residential segregation, school segregation would be in place. But if you achieved change in the courts, then you would have leverage for permanent change, change that would benefit not only you at the moment, hopefully as slowly came into being, but change that would benefit children and grandchildren.
Well, he certainly is a worthy subject, and thank you for your work in making his life well known.
Well, thank you so much.
And thanks for the call. Other calls are welcome. We're talking this morning with Juan Williams, NPR correspondent, author of the book Thurgood Marshall, American Revolutionary. The book, by the way, is published by Three Rivers Press, and you should be able to find it in bookstores and libraries. And Juan Williams will also be speaking tonight at 7 o'clock at the Folinger Auditorium about the life of Thurgood Marshall as part of the University of Illinois' 50th anniversary commemoration of Brown v. Board of Education. If you would like to join our conversation here, the number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. You mentioned Charles Houston. He's one of the biggest influences in Thurgood Marshall's career, and someone who just, I think, I haven't read his biography, but deserves a lot of the credit as well. When Thurgood Marshall joined the student body at Howard University Law School, there seemed to have been a change right there, about that time, brought about by the faculty led by Charles Houston.
Well, it's tremendous change, and change, first of all, in terms of the school itself. Because what happens is this has been a school that was a night school, lots of people attending part-time, questions about its accreditation. And Charles Hamilton Houston, who had been in World War I, who had seen the kind of disparate treatment that black soldiers had received and had represented some of them and tried to prevent them from being executed even for crimes that he thought were unfairly charged, comes back. He becomes a lawyer. His father had been a lawyer in Washington, and then takes on the challenge of reforming Howard University's law school, and he makes it into a day school, raises the standards for not only the students who would be admitted, but for the faculty. That causes a lot of tension, a lot of people who resist that kind of change. And when Marshall shows up, there are 36 students, and he famously says to them, you know, look to your left, look to your right, two of the three of you won't be here in 3 years to graduate. And, history will indicate he was actually optimistic in that judgment because only six of the 36 would graduate in 3 years. So he was really running a boot camp for lawyers, a tremendously difficult training ground, and Marshall thrives in it. Marshall, the party boy, the fraternity boy, who would come through college, as a good time animal, is just takes to it and takes the idea that he is going to be a first-class lawyer. And begins, really the opportunity comes because he becomes the law school librarian, so he doesn't have to worry about that tuition and all the rest. But he does help Charles Hamilton Houston as Houston, for example, conducts a defense of a man who's charged with murder in Virginia. And the man had been had fled to Massachusetts. There was an attempt by the state then to extradite him, to bring him back to Virginia. They try to block that. They can't. Then they're involved with the murder case. Marshall is just excited by the practice of the law, especially even after, the man who was charged in a double murder of two white women. He doesn't have against him an eyewitness. There's no weapon. There's no motive. Nonetheless, he's found guilty. Marshall is just stunned by this, but he's also stunned by the fact the man stands up with a broad smile and embraces Charles Hamilton Houston. And Marshall has to pull Houston aside. What's the celebration for? We just lost. And Houston makes it clear that the man would have been given the death sentence if the jury truly believed that he had committed such a terrible crime that basically what this all-white, very rural jury was saying was, put him in jail for life. But that from the perspective of the man who was on trial and from the perspective of his lawyer, what a victory that his life would not be taken. So this kind of thing just spurs Thurgood Marshall on, and there are other situations where he has sort of hands-on training as a result of dealing with Houston, who's already involved in this kind of struggle to bring equality to the country through the law. And that's the springboard. He stands on Houston's shoulders then as he begins his own law career.
We have another call to talk with. Let's include them in our conversation. Next up, a listener in Urbana on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi, Juan. I'm Betty Williams, and I'm originally from Mississippi. And I think Thurgood Marshall is one of the greatest human beings I've ever read about or heard of. I would like to know, if he was alive today, how would he feel about the war in Iraq, and how would he feel about the president that we have now? Thank you.
Well, Betty, thank you for the call. I don't know exactly what to say. I mean, you know, it's hard to imagine, but I can tell you this, that Marshall was very much an opponent of war, very much a man who believed in Americans promoting democracy, but doing so in an effective way that would have been in line with the law and been in line with the idea that that we have a responsibility to people right here at home, that we have to take care of the home front. He lived through that World War II. Mm-hmm. He's someone who went to Asia to talk about the treatment of American soldiers in Asia. He lived through the whole period of what they call the Double V, victory abroad in World War II as well as victory here at home against racism and oppression. So I think Marshall would have said, you know, let's have one standard. And it's not that he would have been a big fan of liberating the Iraqi people from the oppression of Saddam Hussein. But I think that he would have been one to raise real questions about why we were there and how long we were there and all the rest of it. He would have been an active critic, I think, of the war.
Would he have wanted the UN to been involved in the beginning?
Oh, yeah. You know, it's interesting, Betty. This really takes me someplace because you may not know this, but it's one of these little things about Thurgood Marshall. Mm-hmm. When Kenya was fighting for its independence from Britain, mm-hmm. the government of Kenya, Jomo Kenyatta, goes to Thurgood Marshall, an American lawyer, and ask him to get involved with writing the Constitution for the newly independent Republic of Kenya. Mm. And he does this American, black American lawyer.
Oh.
So Marshall was one who believed deeply in the idea of international law, and would have been a big supporter, I think, of having the UN act to create an international alliance that would help, and it wouldn't simply be an American issue with Iraq.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks very much for the call. We're about at our midpoint with Juan Williams talking about Thurgood Marshall, American Revolutionary, his book on Thurgood Marshall's life and his legacy in the civil rights movement. If you'd like to join us, the number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. Continuing on our narrative of this period of history, when Thurgood Marshall and Charles Houston were at Howard University, they began to be involved, or I think Houston involved Marshall in the NAACP's work on behalf of a number of clients, whether it was criminal cases or educational segregation cases and so forth. And they were trying a new strategy that was designed by a Harvard lawyer, Nathan Margold, not to challenge racial segregation per se, but to insist that states provide truly equal schools for blacks, knowing they couldn't afford it.
Right. Well, knowing they couldn't afford it and therefore forcing them to integrate the white schools. I mean, that was the idea. And this is so interesting because this is all part of, you see a strategy created, you see people who are able to execute the strategy, and then, of course, people who, even as they fade from the scene, are able to hand the baton off to someone like a Thurgood Marshall, this young upcoming lawyer, and get him excited about it, get him committed to it. Possibly, you know, the seminal moment comes when Houston and Marshall are traveling through the South looking at the disparate conditions of black and white schools in southern states, and Marshall, you know, for the first time sees, he knew, of course, of the disparate conditions of black and white schools in his hometown of Baltimore, Maryland. But to see that there were literally shacks that were passed off as schools in Alabama and Mississippi for black kids, to see that teachers did not, wasn't a matter of having secondhand books, but no books, to see that these kids only went to school in the months of December, January, and February, when there weren't crops to be planted or crops to be harvested. This is what real Marshall then is, we talked about having his political consciousness raised gradually, first in college, then in law school, but even after law school, this sense of, you know what, we can accomplish real change and use the law. The law becomes his tool to create a social change in a way that I think is unmatched in American history.
So he forced the course to see that these were not separate but equal schools.
No, he forced the issue. Forced the issue in such a way that, you know, it's interesting. He's not only forcing it in terms of education, which is the focus of the events that we're going to have here today at the University of Illinois and throughout the year commemorating Brown. But if you look at Marshall's legacy, Marshall is one who was involved in breaking down segregation in terms of restricted covenants that kept blacks, Jews, and others from buying property in the best neighborhoods in town. He's also in the key in terms of the Montgomery bus boycott. That case would not have been settled if not for Thurgood Marshall winning it at the Supreme Court. He's also active in terms of parks and housing. He's active in terms of, it's hard to even, I mentioned earlier his efforts overseas where he's arguing with General Douglas MacArthur in Korea and Japan about the treatments of blacks in the military. It goes on in that way where Marshall is just so central to breaking down the walls of racial separation in American society.
We have another caller to include in our conversation. This is a listener in Champaign on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
How are you doing?
Fine, thanks. Thanks
Welcome
for calling.
Welcome to East Central Illinois. I read your book, Thurgood Marshall, American Revolutionary, probably 2 years ago or more. Mm-hmm. And I have two questions. One is quick. I believe you highlighted the black snake, white snake analogy when asked about how he felt about the person who succeeded him on the Supreme Court, the current justice, Clarence Thomas. Is that, in fact, true, or is that an apocryphal story?
That's an apocryphal story. It's one I hear all the time as I travel around. But what happened was, as Marshall was retiring from the court, he held a news conference, and reporters came, and it was an amazing event. But Marshall's sitting there, and people ask him about who should succeed him on the court. Is his seat a black seat? Should that seat always be held by a black person? And would it make a difference in terms of the way the law is interpreted? And Marshall says, unknowing at that moment as to who his successor would be, because no one had been named or nominated, says, that his father taught him that there's no difference between a black snake and a white snake, that they'll both bite you. They're both snakes.
No, but he didn't know at that time that Justice Thomas or
no.
any black justice would succeed him.
No, but what has happened, and I think you pick up on this, it's easy to understand, is that because Thomas is so conservative and such a contrast to Marshall,
right.
and he has generated so much emotion in terms of Americans, beginning with the Anita Hill hearings and all the rest, then that people pick that up and say, that he must have been talking about Justice Thomas. But he didn't know at the time because Thomas hadn't been nominated at the time.
Thank you. My next question is this. It's a sort of a follow-up to what you just said. No doubt Thurgood Marshall is an American hero, and he did bring about great social change through the law. My understanding and my memory of reading your book is that he sometimes questioned Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s notion of bringing about social change for blacks through civil disobedience.
Right.
Now, let me ask you this. Now, as a historian, as a scholar, as a journalist, and as you look at the landscape for blacks today, which of the two visions, the law or civil disobedience, you think has helped blacks the most in obtaining a measure or a modicum of social justice in America?
This is tough because I'm not sure it's an either-or proposition. It's one of these things, and it's interesting. Marshall did see it as an either-or proposition. He said, there's no comparison, that if you want real change, permanent change, where you get the government and the power of the government on your side, you got to make the change in the courthouse, in the law, and have, therefore, the power of the police, the federal government, the Justice Department, the FBI, everybody on your side in any confrontation where your rights are challenged. So he was very much a strong believer that change comes through change in the law. Now, I don't think, though, and I think Marshall was tone deaf to this, I don't think that you get as much change in this country as quickly as you do without Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., without Malcolm X. I think these people, in a sense, are speaking to the culture, to the poetry, speaking to the hearts of people, speaking to the conscience of the nation. Dr. King's appeals coming, you know, from the pulpit in a Christian tradition, you know, I think really touched America in a way that America was never going to be touched by a legal brief. That Judeo-Christian ethic is one that spoke of equality across races. And there was King articulating it in a way that was a challenge to America's conscience. And I just think that, you know, you have to give credit to that. Now, as I say, I know from talking with him, Thurgood Marshall's not one of those people. He would not have been given that credit. He said, you know, you got to be in the courtrooms. And, you know, when you talked about civil disobedience, it reminded me of something else that Thurgood Marshall would say. You know, you put your children in position because of a lunch counter sit-in or a freedom ride or a protest march. What happens to your children who get involved with that? They end up in jail. Who's in charge of the jail? The likes of Bull Connor and some of these other kind of fascist, you know, characters who would delight in beating up these kids or embarrassing them. You know, he was saying, you know, that's not what you want to do. You want to put your children in that kind of danger. He was the one who would say, let's focus on the law. Let's focus on trying to create permanent hard change so that we can speak with authority to the Bull Connors of the world rather than have them reigning over our children in some dark jail cell where we don't know what's going on.
Thank you very much, Warren.
You're welcome, sir.
Thanks for the call. Well, there was also a certain amount of personal rivalry, wasn't there? I mean, Thurgood Marshall was Mr. Civil Rights. And here comes this upstart, you know, Martin Luther King Jr.
Well, he didn't even realize it, you know. I mean, you're exactly right, Jack. Let me just say this first, that in 1959, when Jet Magazine, the black news weekly, asked the question, who's the leading civil rights figure in America? The answer, I think, to many people today would be a surprise. It's not Martin Luther King Jr., who had then been on the scene for a few years. It's Thurgood Marshall. But Marshall is the guy who I think felt right from the start, you know, oh, this King is an interesting guy. He's a nice man. He knew his father and all the rest. Marshall had already won the Brown case. He's getting married for the second time. His first wife had died. And he's going off on vacation when the Montgomery bus boycott gets started as this little thing. And a request for help from the NAACP in terms of the law, challenging the law at the time the Montgomery bus system was privately owned, so you couldn't challenge the government. It was like, well, wait a minute, this is a privately run bus company, and so how does the law handle this? And Marshall asked one of the lawyers in his office to help with this as a favor to some other people down in Montgomery, Alabama, and goes off on his honeymoon, comes back and is amazed at all the headlines and all the controversy over what's taking place in Montgomery, and then doubly amazed that this young man, who's then about 25 years old, Martin Luther King Jr., has become a national sensation because of his terrific ability as a speaker and as a leader. And it's only later that he comes to understand that people view King's work on par with what he's doing. From his perspective, what madness. He's been in the vineyard, you know, since the 30s, working to change the laws and to do away with segregation. And he sees King as a newcomer, and he sees him as someone who's a great speaker, but certainly not creating the kind of change that he has.
There's a great deal of drama to this story. As Thurgood Marshall and his colleagues are traveling in Jim Crow South and all these places where they're arguing court cases, and some of them are criminal cases and others are school integration cases and so forth, a lot of personal danger for them.
Oh, yeah. You know, and I always think it's funny. In some of these places, they put Marshall in the back of a hearse. So it appears like it's there's a coffin in their dead person. In order to protect them, they move him from house to house. In one case, he was in a house that was bombed. And the guy that was trying to bomb him, actually, the bomb went off too early. So the man who was a bomber is injured, and Marshall has to come out. And people are trying to help this man who's dying, you know, from wounds that, in a sense, self-inflicted, because he was the one who was who created the bomb and was going to launch it at the house where Marshall was staying. Marshall moved from house to house in many of these cases. You have situations where, you know, he goes into, I remember, challenging the all-white primary in the state of Texas, where it was a Democratic Party who held all-white primaries. And Marshall was very intent on challenging this because so many of the politicians in Washington, the congressmen, especially from the southern states, Democrats, but segregationists. And as they were segregationists as a result of the exclusion of blacks and oftentimes women, as well as Hispanics, from the primary process. So by the time that people got to vote across racial lines in the general election, they were had to choose between one segregationist and another. I mean, there was no opportunity to get someone who was of a different way of thinking in there. So Marshall is down in Texas challenging this, and at one point when he's involved with this challenge, there are challenges to his life, to his safety. Another point, he's down in Texas, same state, same situation comes up. He's challenging the right of blacks to serve on juries, which was taken as a given, but in fact, blacks were always excluded in the process. And he's told that he should not come to Dallas because the police chief is going to threaten and kill him. I mean, this is unbelievable in this day and age. Yeah,
right.
The police chief is going to kill you if you show up. The other side of this is sort of the legendary side is that black people in small towns and big cities, when they were able to finally get on Thurgood Marshall's agenda, and the idea was that Thurgood Marshall was going to come in and argue a case and challenge the laws of segregation in their community, they would use this refrain. They'd say, Thurgood's a-coming. Thurgood's a-coming. It was like a promise. It was like, you know, there was going to be a day of redemption because of the power that this man had in the courtroom.
We just have about 12 or 13 minutes left, and there's a whole lot to cover. That I'm sure we won't get to all of it. There were a couple of cases leading up to Brown v. Board of Education. I wanted to ask you to talk a little bit about the Sweat case. This was the first case that went to the Supreme Court, which essentially resulted in really the first ruling to the effect that separate but equal wasn't acceptable, at least as applied to law schools.
Well, what you have in the Sweat case and Sweat v. Painter is this idea of people working so hard to challenge, still on the basis of separate but equal, segregation in the graduate and professional schools. And so in Sweat, what you have is for the first time someone saying, well, wait a second, if we're going to have separate facilities, is it possible that we could have the students simply outside in a separate classroom? And they could sit in the hallway even and listen to what's going on in the classroom with the white students? Or do they actually have to be seated in the same classroom? You know, you laugh, Jack, but it sounds so silly, but this is the reality. This is the kind of step by step, that America had to go through to break down segregation.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's also amazing is that a lot, at least in the case of, I think it was in Missouri or the law school in Missouri, the faculty and the white students wanted to have the black students in the same school.
Yeah, that was in Oklahoma.
Oklahoma, okay.
In the Oklahoma situation, the white students were, you know, it's fine with us. What's the problem here? But again, it's the political structure, it's the political establishment that is just resistant to this change. And so you have people who aren't even at the school who are trying to enforce this law. And you know, all kinds of craziness, you know. Is this guy going to sit next to white girls? This black guy, is he going to sit next to? And so, oh, my God. So then there's all this kind of sexual tension. You know, mm-hmm. is that what this is about?
Mm-hmm.
Or where will he eat? Where will he stay on campus? Well, it turns out the guy is married. You know, the guy has a whole life. I mean, he's going to law school.
Mm-hmm.
But all these fears and emotions, and I think then you can come to understand the enormity of the task. That it's really, Marshall is hammering at the heart in terms of the law, but there's so much more. In terms of the culture, in terms of the fear, in terms of the history that goes back, of course, to slavery, then to Jim Crow segregation and to the denial of equal rights. There's so much that has to be dealt with. And in a sense, when we think about Brown now, 50 years later, we're still dealing with so many of those shadows and echoes. I don't know if it's fair to call them shadows and echoes because so much of it is hard reality. But so much of that kind of baggage around Brown that remains.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In fact, one of the strategies he employed to argue the case of Brown is really, I think, what we're talking about when we speak of these shadows and the baggage, and that is the psychological damage that segregation causes to human beings. They actually had research, psychological, sociological research, to show that segregating black students away from white students was inherently harmful to the students.
Yeah, and in fact, this was very controversial, Jack, because at the time, and controversial not even at first in terms of the court, but at first among the lawyers on Marshall's own legal team at the NAACP, Marshall gets Kenneth Clark, the psychologist, and Mamie Clark, his wife, involved. They go down into South Carolina, one of the five cases that are known as Brown v. Board. Brown v. Board is actually the five cases. I think it's Kansas, South Carolina, Virginia, Delaware, and the District of Columbia. And what Clark does is this famous dolls test where he asks the black students to look at these black and white dolls and, you know, which one's prettier, which one's smarter, which one has the better possibilities in the future. And the black children looking at these black dolls would say that the black doll is dumber than the white doll. The black doll is uglier than the white doll. The white doll is always the prettier one. That the black doll has less of a future. And, you know, this kind of damage to it, this is an elementary school child speaking this way. And, of course, the black doll looks like that child. And you then come to understand the depths of damage done at a very young age by a thoroughly segregated nation to its children. And so that's part of it. And we, you know, we hear refrains of that to this day. I might say that there are arguments about whether or not the Brown decision was based on too much sociological evidence. That argument then takes place among the justices on the court, and critics to this day argue about whether or not Brown was sociology as opposed to law. Mm-hmm. But you hear echoes of this argument to this day in terms of issues about self-esteem. Why is there an achievement gap between black and white students? Does it have to do with different sense of expectations, maybe even black students thinking that if you study hard, you're acting white and all the rest? I think it's all, in essence, a refrain of that central argument in Brown.
Very interesting. We have just about 7 minutes left with Juan Williams, author of the book Thurgood Marshall, American Revolutionary. If you'd like to join us real quick, we can take your questions. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free anywhere else, 800-222-9455. There's a lot, actually, that we're kind of glossing over, and so I would certainly suggest people read the book. One of the things that was amazing to read about is the elation upon the decision in Brown v. Board of Education was soon kind of deflated because really not much happened right away.
Well, you know, it's 10 years before you start to see really integration of schools in the country. I mean, some places it happens fairly quickly. The District of Columbia, areas of Delaware, actually Kansas is one of the places where it comes pretty quickly. The government there did not really have a much problem with it. But in the southern states, my gosh, they viewed, you know, that May 17th decision as Black Monday. Oh, my gosh. And massive resistance then takes root. And you have places like Prince Edward County, Virginia, where they close all the schools so that the black kids can't go to school. They put the white kids in these academies, these segregationist academies to educate them, some of which exist to this day. And so you start to see then the kind of threat that people viewed Brown as constituting, that they saw Brown as the end of their way of southern segregated life. And you, of course, it leads to famous moments such as George Wallace's stand in the schoolhouse door to stop the integration of the University of Alabama. We just passed a commemoration of what happened back in 62 with James Meredith finally breaking the color barrier at the University of Mississippi, where National Guardsmen were shot to death because they were escorting him and trying to allow him to attend school there. These things are unbelievable, but all part of the history and the aftermath of what was this earth-shaking moment in legal and American political cultural history, Brown versus Board of Education, May 17th, 1954.
We have a caller on line number four. Let's include them before we run out of time here. This is a listener in Terre Haute on line number four. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yeah, Juan, I really enjoy seeing you on Fox.
Oh, thank you.
On Sundays mainly, and I think you bring a lot of balance to it. And I think it's one of the reasons they can say it's fair and balanced.
Yeah, I hope so.
They've got you and Myra on there.
Yeah, Myra Elias in the National Public Radio.
Unfortunately, I don't see the same balance on public radio. They have only one guy, Dan Shore, and Myra every once in a while, and that really is a problem to me. Could you comment on the balance between, say, Fox and public radio?
Well, you know, I think most people would say that the struggle to attain balance in journalism is ongoing, but Fox, people say, is too conservative for them. I actually think that if you look at the news coverage on Fox, it is fair and balanced. It's the commentators. It's the Bill O'Reillys, the Sean Hannitys, who are, without a doubt, coming from the right. On National Public Radio, man, do we make an effort to be actually fair and balanced. And yet, you know, I think in part because we make this tremendous effort, you have listeners who say, but you said this just not quite the right way. And we get a lot of that, especially with regard to what goes on in the Middle East. But you should know that I mean, I'm in both journalistic operations, and there is such an effort to try to deliver that fair and balanced product to you, not only at Fox, but especially at NPR. And NPR labors under, I think, the burden of people saying, oh, you guys have been liberal for years. You came out of so many college communities. You were leftist back in the Vietnam War and all that. And, of course, the work that was done by the likes of a Daniel Schorr during the Watergate years and all the rest. But, you know, to my mind, if you look at the listenership surveys, it's a third conservative, a third self-identified as liberal, and a third identified as independent. But the image of NPR, I must agree with what you said, is much more liberal.
Well, one, they could really help that image if they just got one semi-conservative commentator besides Daniel Schorr. I mean, when you only can hear Daniel Schorr, there's just no doubt that all you're getting is liberal analysts.
Oh, that's interesting because, you know, so many people would say that Daniel Schorr was a liberal. So I'm interested that you think of Daniel and his commentary as more conservative. And
I didn't say that. No, I didn't say that. I said you only have Daniel Schorr be liberal.
Oh, I see your point.
You need balance with Daniel Schorr.
I agree. I understand your point. It's something I will convey to people back at NPR. So thanks for that call.
Okay, thanks for the call. We only have a couple minutes left. There's a lot of ground we can't cover. One of the earlier callers asked the question, what would Thurgood Marshall think about, you know, the current policy with regard to Iraq, et cetera. I do know that, you know, I'm sure you talked to him about this. You write about it in the book how in his later years in the Supreme Court, the court was swinging way back to the right, right. And he was very disturbed about that. And I guess, you know, there are all these issues, the death penalty, privacy, Miranda, which he was involved in, that have since swung way back to the right. And I'm not sure, you know, he would how he would feel about the direction of the court since he has passed away almost 10 years ago. But certainly he would be disappointed.
Oh, I think that he was disappointed when he was alive. I mean, he felt that the Rehnquist court was, in fact, undoing much of what had been done by the Warren court. And, you know, he was not a big fan even of Warren Burger when Burger comes in as a replacement for Rehnquist. And through those years, and he felt as if he was being pushed more and more to the left and the court was moving more and more to the right. But toward the end there, where you have cases dealing with race and you have more and more of this appeal to color blindness and what he thought was a refusal to see the reality that we're an extremely color conscious society, he felt that there was that the court was losing touch with reality. So he, in a sense, isolated himself over to the far left wing of the Supreme Court with his very good friend Bill Brennan. So you have these two very liberal justices on this court that was moving more and more to the right, led by Rehnquist, Scalia. So I don't think there's any question Marshall would say that, you know, he was writing toward the end, writing his dissents almost in isolation and writing them for future generations when he hopes that the pendulum will swing back at least to the center.
We're going to have to leave it there since we're out of time, but I will suggest to folks a couple of things. First of all, they can look for the book Thurgood Marshall, American Revolutionary, by our guest Juan Williams. The book is published by Three Rivers Press, and it surely would be found in bookstores and libraries. And also, if you'd like to hear more from Juan Williams on Thurgood Marshall, he will be speaking tonight at 7 o'clock at the Fullinger Auditorium on the campus of the University of Illinois. This is the inaugural event of the university's 50th anniversary commemoration of Brown v. Board of Education. So you are certainly welcome to attend that. And Juan Williams, thanks so much for being here.
Jack, what a pleasure to be with you. Thank you.